later on, I think, when I started looking in art historically in more detail at the kinds of movements in England that and of people who had admired Tagore, I think Annie Besant did, didn't she?
Yeah.
What one realized was that in spite of, or precisely because of, the terrors of British colonial rule in India, of all the British colonial peoples, the Indian, and particularly Indians, the central Indian languages form part of the nexus of the Aryan tradition through the invention of the idea of the Indo-European mother tongue, which goes back to the late 18th century in Switzerland, actually, to Ferdinand de Saussure's ancestors, and Adolf Pictet. And I've just been reading recently this huge biography of Saussure, which in a way sort of confirms some of these things which I thought about but didn't see through so many years ago. And so there's always a possibility where the black and the yellow remains abject and inadmissible in culture, unless you're a Chinese specialist or a Japanese specialist, not the same thing. What can become universal is a voice from India because of the Sanskrit language and because of the Indo-European mother tongue, which is a supposition. I mean, the mother tongue, as far as I can see, is derived by black hole, like black holes in space, from a series of symptoms which you wish to ascribe to an origin, which is, say, the conversion of the Sanskrit N into a whole set of Western vowels. So I think that those kind of things are fascinating. I didn't know much about them. I think when we went through the linguistic turn and all became sociologists, we knew nothing about those things. That's the amazing thing. We knew nothing about them. So I'm wondering in what way those, if you like, and it's important, sort of racial, colonial, profound stereotypes of the details of what language is, may still haunt us in the way in which we might now look at Tagore differently or positively in terms of notions like cosmopolitanism, in terms of notions like decolonizing the self, and to what extent one is able to think that through a talk from within the ghost of the Indo-European paradigm. That's what I'm wondering about. That remains speculative at this stage, but I think it's something that needs to be taken on, needs to be taken on in terms of the facility with which that upper class English strata founded Dartington were happy with that, if you like, were at ease with that. So that's something that I think. Now the other thing I've been looking at in preparation today, very briefly, is that once you take that on, you have to take on the ways in which clearly Tagore is centered and produced as universal by the number of different people who are interested in him. So although people are in tiny bits of him, like I was going through on Spotify yesterday, the number of contemporary rock singers interested in Tagore, and it's fabulous, actually. So they place him on the pedestal. At the same time, in the 1920s and 30s, the French avant-garde musicians, Lissis, placed him on the pedestal. And some of them set his poems to music. Some of his earliest settings of his music in Western music come from Paris in the end of the 1920s and 30s. So all those different fragmented forces tend to place someone in the position of being as if universal. So the other thing I was thinking we might do over this project is to think about the way in which we can realize the vast quantity, figuring the vast quantity of fragmentary Tagores in such a way as we see what constitutes as a universal one way, that seen as another way shatters it into a thousand little pieces, which we don't need to take together. Mm-hmm. We don't need to put them back together. Mm-hmm. They can just be this Indian rock singer's that British twits, this, that's what I wanted to start off by saying today. Those two figures, the Indo-European mother tongue, does it haunt us? The fragmentation which tends to result in an involuntary universalizing is another.